This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 a.m. It is the 7th of May, and it is a wet one today. Hope that folks are staying dry and didn't get caught in the downpour this morning. I certainly did, but it looks like it's going to dry up across the day. So, you know, if you haven't left the house yet, then you're a winner. Now, we have, as usual, a fantastic lineup of segments for you today. And starting off, we are going to be playing a poem by artist Textaqueen. Now, this follows our conversations with disability advocate Andrew Bretherton about the Albanese government's planned cuts to the NDIS in the May budget, which is handed down next Tuesday, and landfill responds to the systemic devaluation of disabled people's insights and embodiment in legislative decision-making processes. And there is a National Day of Action to protect our NDIS, this Saturday, the 9th of May, from 1 p.m. at the State Library in NARM, Melbourne. And to find the time and locations of other actions around the country, you can go to Instagram and search Protect Our NDIS, where you will get all of the latest information about the campaign. After that, we are going to replay a segment from FBI Radio's Race Matters and Young Prodigy Mentorship Radio series. Now, SOIL was a radio mentorship designed for young people through the model of liberatory radio and community-centered well-being, and it covered 6 workshops alongside shared meals, new friendships, and audio ventures. And in this segment, guest producer Virginia Barahona is joined by community builder and Young Prodigy founding director Maya Ihemeje. And so we are very excited to play that segment for you and really encourage you to follow the work of Young Prodigy. After that, we'll be joined by Chris Cristoforo, who's the CEO of VADA, to discuss report number 25 of the National Wastewater Drug Monitoring Program, which is based on new data collected from December 2024 to October 2025. Now, in August of 2025, the program covered 50% of the population, about 14.5 million people, and it provides a comprehensive picture of Australia's illicit drug markets and drug consumption habits for 12 substances. So they'll be unpacking this latest set of data and what it tells us about drug consumption patterns and what's needed in terms of harm reduction supports. And then we are joined by Craig Wilkins, National Co-Director of the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance, or MDCA, who speaks with us about the review currently underway into the operation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, which is the framework that governs Australia's largest river system. Now, MDCA is among a number of groups that have raised some significant concerns around whether the plan has been able to achieve its set objectives, particularly with regard to climate change sensitive environmental management. And finally, last but not least, Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria will be joining us to continue the conversation about those serious issues raised with the City of Melbourne's so-called Community Safety Officer program. And they're going to be sharing updates about and responses from the City of Melbourne since this news broke in early April, including the outcome of a meeting between HPU Vic and Lord Mayor Nick Rees earlier this week. Now, HPU Vic is holding a public gathering outside Melbourne Town Hall from 5 p.m. next Tuesday, the 15th of May. I feel like I have that date wrong. You know what? I will double check that. But to find out more about how you can get involved in the Big Lean and keep up with Homeless Persons Union of Victoria's work, head to Homeless Persons Union Vic on Instagram. And apologies for that. I will come back to you with the correct date and time for that gathering. Now we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 7th of May. Despite strong community opposition, councillors in the city of Port Phillip voted last night in favour of a motion to change local laws that will allow forceful removal of belongings from homeless encampments. Those rallying against the motion say the proposed operating protocol between the council and Victoria Police will entrench a coordinated enforcement approach that prioritises moving people on over addressing the root causes of homelessness. The local law protocol will include joint patrols with council officers and police, surveillance and forced so-called resolution of encampments. In other news this week, legal experts are calling for the establishment of an independent police ombudsman in Victoria, warning that increased taser use by police demands stronger oversight and accountability. Tasers are rolled out to all frontline officers, and last year Victoria Police deployed tasers in 1,209 incidents. Between 2018 and 2023, police caused 161 injuries from tasers and used tasers on 149 minors. Over the past two decades, police tasers have been linked to at least 18 deaths in so-called Australia. Also in news this week, council workers across nine Victorian municipalities conducted a 24-hour strike on Tuesday, marking one of the largest local government industrial actions in decades as they continue to push for a 10% pay raise and improve conditions after years of real wage decline. The action, involving services such as waste collection and libraries, comes amid stalled negotiations with councils, with unions arguing workers have had no pay increase for 2 years. Unions are also criticising some councils for punitive responses and attempts to undermine earlier industrial action. And finally, in headlines, a Senate inquiry has heard renewed calls to dismantle the Albanese government's offshore processing regime, with evidence showing widespread abuse, corruption, and long-term harm to refugees held in Nauru and Papua New Guinea over more than a decade. The public hearings come as the government indicates that it will be moving to expand the system, including plans that would see hundreds of people deported to Nauru on long-term visas, raising concerns that they may face continued neglect, dangerous conditions, and prolonged uncertainty. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 7th of May, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Now, I wanted to let people know about an event that is happening today. This is a national action and a series of national vigils that have been called to commemorate the life and to bear in mind the tragic loss of Kumanjayi Little Baby. Now, this action in NARM will be held from 5:30 to 7 p.m. today, Thursday, the 7th of May, for a 6 p.m. start at the Aborigines Advancement League, number 2 Watt Street in Thornbury. Attendees are asked to please bring a candle and to wear pink, and we are going to be gathering to honour the life of Kumanjayi Little Baby, holding space for her family community, and to stand united against violence towards Aboriginal children. So again, that is a NARM community vigil for Kumanjayi Little Baby, and that is held today, Thursday the 7th of May, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. with a 6 p.m. start at the Aborigines Advancement League. That is number 2 Watt Street in Thornbury. So please make it there if you can. Bring a candle and wear pink.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And following our conversation with disability advocate Andrew Bretherton over the past 2 weeks about the Albanese government's planned cuts to the NDIS in the May budget, we wanted to share a poem by artist Textaqueen. Now, this poem, Landfill, responds to the systematic devaluation of disabled people's lives and insight and embodiment in legislative decision-making processes. In this piece, Textaqueen pushes through dehumanising narratives cultivated by the Albanese government's unjust economic strategy to remind us that people living with a disability will remain grieving, relating, desiring, creating, suffering, and resisting. Now, there is a National Day of Action to protect our NDIS that is happening this Saturday, the 9th of May, 1 p.m. at Melbourne State Library. And to find the time and locations of other national actions, you can go to Instagram and search Protect Our NDIS.
Care note, live burial, eugenics. Landfill. They pile us in the pit, all the othered bodies, still alive, but without purpose, according to the council laws. We know we will be blamed for the unstable ground when they slab down their buildings on the soil they tip upon us. Some of us topple ourselves in the pit, not because we want to die. We only seek relief from the unrelenting deafening of life above ground, already pushed to the precipice by the ever-expanding construction zone. The council owns the site, set to profit with the pretense of redistributing support to all citizens, instead spending more funds on the campaign that maintains that pretense. There are those that count themselves lucky to be involved at all in construction, given temporary contracts to draw the plans, supply the materials, or pour concrete over the less fortunate. Some relish putting us out of sight. Some are in denial that anything living is below. Many are motivated by fear that if they don't do the work, the pit will swallow them too, only to find themselves collapsing into cement they just laid. Witness new subcontractors appear to continue the labour, leaving them, who are now us, entombed alive. The council declares that we are an inert foundation, instructs the site manager to arrange for us to be neatly tiled over, hiding any cracks, keeping on schedule to complete their project yet to be named. We may inhale dirt, be seemingly immobile to them, but most of us continue to breathe, left to do our own work, supporting each other to survive below ground, knowing our collective warmth is what may keep us alive.
That was a beautiful poem, Landfill, by disabled creator and artist Texta Queen. And we wanted to play that after, you know, the consideration that we've had over the past few weeks about the massive impacts that cuts to the NDIS or attempts to minimize the growth of the scheme will have materially on the lives of disabled folks around so-called Australia. Now, we wanted to also remind people to support the National Day of Action to Protect our NDIS, which is happening this Saturday, the 9th of May. And in Melbourne, that is happening from 1 p.m. outside the State Library of Victoria. But to find the time and locations of other actions around the country, you can head to Instagram and search Protect our NDIS. And there will be actions around the country, and we will share a list of those in our show notes. You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:16 in the morning.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No, no, no. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Wow, I say that so often, and yet I have just stumbled over it. Fun fact, according to my partner a couple of weeks ago, they came to bed and I turned to them in my sleep and said, good morning, you're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, which is just a sign of how much this show lives in my head rent-free. Think about Thursday Breakfast all the time. And now we are going to replay a segment from FBI Radio's Race Matters and Young Prodigy Mentorship radio series. Now, SOIL was a radio mentorship designed for young people through the model of liberatory radio and community-centered well-being. It spanned 6 workshops, shared meals, new friendships, and audio ventures. Guest producer Virginia Barahona is joined by community builder and Young Prodigy founding director Maya Himeje for a poignant conversation unraveling the contradictions of the so-called justice system and making clear the work of Young Prodigy as an organization that centers young people whose experience of the prison industry system is most often unseen.
It's so important that we speak about it as a communal conversation, because we are inherently communal beings, you know what I mean? Like, we exist and coexist with one another and in groups and as collectives. And I think the carceral system doesn't actually acknowledge that. It doesn't honor that. And everything is really individualized. And it's kind of like you just remove one person out of a bigger community or a bigger setting. And I think that that's why it's so important that we kind of remind ourselves and bring it back, you know, to the fact that when we incarcerate someone, whether it's a mother, father, brother, sister, friends, confidant, whoever, we're removing someone from a network and from a community, and that's going to be felt, you know, in ripples, not just within, you know, that individual person. Yeah. So I think that's why, yeah, it's so important that we kind of look at it from a collective loss and grief, actually.
Yeah, I really like how I haven't really, like, it, yeah, the ripple effect, it really spoke to me in the letter, like, yeah, I guess what's been happening recently with the protests that happened a couple days ago, there was a lot of police brutality and violence. I wanted to ask what we mean when we're talking about incarceration in this colony.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's been a very heavy week, particularly, but I think heavy year, 2 years, lifetime, all of that. It's a lot. So I think for me, when we're talking about incarceration in this colony, I just feel like it's basically rebranding the ongoing colonial violence of this state, of this settler colony. You know, similarly to what we see with the out-of-home care system, you know, back in the day, people were just removing children, and they still are today, but now it's just been rebranded as, you know, in a different way. And I think I see that similarly with incarceration in this place. I was actually watching a video this morning, an old interview, First Nations person speaking to the fact that, you know, when they are profiled, going to the police, you're told, go sort it out yourself. Like, what am I going to do about it? And then when you do that, you are punished, you know? Yeah. So it's like, it's set up exactly the way that it's supposed to be. So, yeah, they've just rebranded, the ongoing.
This is a silent narrative. We don't hear about the parental incarceration, and then we don't get to hear about the experience of the youth that are affected by this, so their kids and stuff like that. You created Young Prodigy, which I thought was really amazing, and you've done a lot of work to undo the system of incarceration, and you support young people, give them a voice and a space to talk about things that maybe in other spaces they're not able to talk about. So you're making these stories visible. Why young people at the heart of what you do?
I think young people at the heart of what we do, basically kind of what you are saying, this is such an invisible issue, yet it is such an interconnected issue. And I think the carceral system, the prison industrial complex, there are so many different pipelines and ways that it just kind of like traps us and sucks us down, you know, and this is one of them. And this is one that isn't spoken about as much. So I think it's actually really important that we center the young people who have this lived experience, so that, you know, when people are coming up with programs or policies or whatever it may be, it's made sure that it's grounded in that living experience, and it's grounded in truth and in knowledge, and not just, you know, from someone who's at DCJ, like sitting up at, you know, level 22 of some building in the middle of Pitt Street somewhere. I think it's so important that it is grounded in our truth and by us, because at the end of the day, what's working, or the strategies at the moment, sorry, are not working. We know it's not working. And that's why recidivism rates are up, I think, over 40%, you know, and that's over 50% for young people that are incarcerated as well. Like, it is not working. So we need to completely flip it on its head and take matters into our own hands. And I think that's why it's so important that we center the young people in these conversations. We're innovative. We're the young people. Like, it's not working. You know, flip it.
When I was doing some research, I was having a look at your website. It's really cool and awesome. And you guys do a retreat every year. The different kind of things you do in the retreat for young people, and what they learn from it and what you learn from it as well.
So fortunately enough, now we're able to do three a year, which is really, really exciting. So our next one is going to be coming up the end of March. Then we'll have another one in June and in December. But essentially, the community retreats are actually an entry point for young people to take part and get to connect with us and kind of have a feel for who we are and what we do. But also, it's kind of, I hate using like language like this, but it's really like our governance structure, and that's how we embed and make sure that what people tell us, we do. And, you know, these are the spaces where young people can hold us accountable. You know, last year they said we wanted to do A, B, and C. Like, have we done that? You know, so I think it serves that purpose. But also, it's a space just to come together, connect, unpack. The very first retreat that we did was so eye-opening to me. I mean, as someone that has lived experience, there were so many other layers I didn't even consider or think of, or didn't even cross my mind. And that was coming from me, right? You know, I'm talking about literally being born inside. I'm talking about people whose parents are political prisoners, you know, like the layers of this experience are so deep and so profound. And I think having a space like a community retreat where people have this experience, but different levels to it, I guess, for lack of a better word. I think it's such a beautiful space where, you know, people can feel seen and be like, oh my gosh, like that happened to me too, but in this completely different context, but it's all kind of interconnected. Yeah. So I think that's why it's super important and integral. But really, it's shaped by our community, you know, like, of course, like from, you know, project side of things, we're going to have, you know, this is what we're going to do from this time in this space, blah, blah, blah. But if the young people kind of come to us and they're like, actually, I don't want to do that, and I want to go to the park and just like hang out and have ice cream, then like, we'll do that as well. Or maybe they're like, no, like, I want to like create a plan, like a campaign for, you know, like, for example, making prison calls free across New South Wales or something like this, and we can facilitate that as well. So it's really kind of guided by what people are feeling and sensing, and ensuring that we can pay homage to that and contribute to that.
What do you think YP does that is different to other orgs in the so-called justice network?
How do I say this without coming across a certain type of way?
Yeah,
okay, go in, why not?
You're allowed to say whatever you want.
This is FBI, let's go.
Yes, totally.
I think there is a weird kind of politics when it comes to these spaces. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of organizations, you know, they are non-for-profits and all of this, and we are trying to survive, you know, in this world, in these crises. Yeah. And so with that comes a lot of reliance on bigger institutions to kind of fund or resource and things like that. And that's fantastic and that's great. But with that kind of comes some strings attached. You know, like, you can do this amazing thing you want to do, but don't talk about it in this way or don't go about it in this way. You know, you kind of need to match the funder or the resources, like politics in a way, or their policy or like how they want to be perceived. You know what I mean? And I think for us, what makes us different is we are so staunch and so clear in the fact that we don't want to be like that. You know, we would love to partner with you, but if you aren't going to rock with us in A, B, or C way, then that's just not going to happen. And I think while that may hinder quote unquote growth, however we want to perceive that, in a way, I think that holding that integrity is what really differentiates us and allows us to be able to speak in the way that we do and not be like, oh my God, after this FBI radio interview, like, is someone going to call me and be like, Maya, like, you shouldn't have said blah, 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 you know? Like, so I think like that's what really does set us apart in this space, and the fact that we're youth-led, you know, no one else is doing this work that we're doing.
I think it really was like the first time I've heard of a youth-led thing, like,
really?
I don't know if I hear too often of youth being able to give their input and be like, actually, I don't want to do this and this isn't working for me, because in some youth spaces it's like, okay, this is the program we have, you're going to follow this, and like, this is the outcome of like what you're going to do. So it was really interesting to me that it's youth-led, and I guess that's what makes it really special.
I think that's kind of a bit of a critique within the sector, like more broadly when it comes to the youth space. It's like, everyone who's in the space doesn't have any understanding or proximity to anything about the community that they're quote unquote working with or working for, however they want to frame it. And it's really sad. And I think that's why we're not really seeing things change, because we have a bunch of people who, you know, are so disconnected from the reality on the ground, and, you know, it's not working. So I think,
and it's definitely about like those young people working together rather than having like some older person come in. Nothing wrong with that, but like just telling kids what to do and stuff like that.
So
it's really amazing.
Thank you.
What have these stories taught you about the impact of working with young people impacted by parental incarceration?
I think what it's really taught me is that we don't know what we don't know. I think, I mean, I kind of mentioned it before and I do, you know, go on about it a lot, but in these justice movements and conversations and dialogues, who else is missing? And I think what Young Prodigy really unveils is a whole cohort, a whole community, a whole group of people that are missing. And I think our voices and our stories and our realities and, you know, our proximity to the justice system, whatever that may look like, bringing that lens to the conversation is beyond me, right? And I know when we first kind of started out and we're talking to different people in the space, they were just like, oh my gosh, I didn't even think of it in this way. Like, why were we not, you know, including this experience or young people in this way? And I think, acknowledging how it intersects with, you know, the youth justice system, out of home care system and all these types of things as well. I think that's really where the impact comes in, to kind of acknowledge, oh my gosh, this experience is so interconnected with everything else in the broader so-called justice system. So yeah, that's kind of really where I see it. And the fact that we're so unapologetic as well, I really think that that's our power and that's where our impact kind of comes in. There's been some spaces that we've shown up in and people kind of look at us like, oh, they're just these, you know, cute young people. They're going to, you know, do, I don't even know what they kind of think. But when we actually start talking or facilitate a workshop or whatever it may be, people kind of like, oh, wow, like they know what they're talking about. And actually, this is a good idea. Maybe we should implement it in some way, you know, and that's kind of manifested in a way. For example, we've now been asked to establish a youth arm to an international coalition for this experience, right? Just because of the way we facilitated and held space. So it kind of, yeah, it was really reaffirming that we know what we're talking about. We're not just like these cute little young people that are just here to kind of, you know, speak on a panel about our lived experience. It's like, no, we actually have ideas and ways to move forward. And yeah, it's really cool to be honored for that.
Who are the facilitators in the workshop?
So the specific one that I'm referring to, it was myself and there was three other young people with lived experience that came to the initial community retreat. So yeah, it was us and Lil, who you would know, who's our amazing program coordinator.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was
and
deadly.
Do those youth young people that are at those retreats, can they in the future maybe become facilitators as well for retreats like that?
That is the plan. That is one of the big picture plans, just because I think as well in the youth space, for a bit of context, there's this concept of like aging out. So like once you kind of, you know, hit that 25 years, get out of here, you know, and that's actually where the origin of Young Prodigy kind of came from. I was like, well, what happens once we're 18, we're not considered children, we're just kind of like sidelined. So that was one of the issues that we really tried to kind of overcome. So I love that you asked that question. So for us, it'd be great to get young people to kind of transition into different roles. Like, do you want to be a facilitator? One of our young people is about to start studies in psychology. Like, cool, like how could you facilitate, you know, something at the retreat or at a different program that speaks to you, you know, your new career path that you're going down, you know, the new skill that you're developing. So yeah, we're definitely trying to find different avenues and different ways for young people to contribute. So
it's really cool. Yeah, I feel like those programs with people that actually have lived experience feel more effective versus someone that's just like giving a lecture or like
definitely
telling you strategies and ways to cope with things. So that's really amazing.
We are sick of the reports and the reports and the consultation and the things. It's like, okay, like cute, but like, oh, what are we doing now?
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. Especially for young people
At the moment as well.
What role does Young Prodigy play in a future without prison?
I think this kind of speaks to what I was mentioning before, but keeping that vision alive. Sometimes in these spaces and in the work that we do, you know, we want to pivot to kind of get to the destination. Like, you know, I can see it, I can almost touch it, I can almost taste it, but I just need to kind of pivot to get there, if that makes sense. You know, whether that be going into partnership with someone that might not align or whatever that may look like, I think for us, keeping that 2020 vision and staying true to ourselves is, you know, a really critical role. It's so easy to kind of drift away, to be like, well, if I do something in this way, then it'll get me to where I want to get to. But will it? Like, did we just kind of like divert a little bit? So I think, yeah, keeping vision and staying true, like at this climate particularly, is, a really important role, I think. Yeah, what I'm noticing, like what I'm kind of saying here, there's this like key theme of being present in the now to be able to achieve that, you know, future idea.
Talk about abolition, it being like a very imaginative and political movement, and you yourself are constantly like dreaming up new ways of building worlds for these people. What does abolition dreaming mean to you?
Yeah, so for me, I think abolition dreaming is really important to think of the now in order to get to the future, if that kind of makes sense. I think In a lot of the conversations about abolition, we talk about the end result and what we want to see, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And that's fantastic. And that's great. But what does that look like here and now? You know, in 3 years, like, I would love to be able to do this, but I highly doubt that I'm going to get rid of the whole prison industrial complex in 3 years, you know. But within 3 years, what I can do is establish a space where, you know, young people or whoever in the community can get support, can get fresh food, can get, you know, adequate healthcare and all those things. Like, I think the way I envision, the way that I see it is actually at this point in time, you know, making the current system redundant in a sense and replacing that with our own system, you know. Back in the day, I would, and even now to an extent, you know, admittedly, I used to work, you know, for a big institution, did the whole hoo-ha, you know, I can change it from inside, all of that, you know. But I think what that really taught me is actually, let's just, like, do whatever you want over there, but, like, we're doing this over here, so we need to make sure that there's another option, another way forward for people that is away from that. So for me, dreaming is about being realistic and in the now so that we can achieve what we want to achieve in the future.
Yeah, because I've had, like, conversations with people before and they've been like, yeah, it's all good to be like, let's tear it down, let's get rid of it, but, like, how are we actually going to get there? Like, we actually need to talk about tangible, real ways of, like, getting to that.
Exactly.
Even though we talk so much about, like, resisting and, like, all these kinds of things. So, a quote on your website by Cornel West that says, never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. And... yeah, I just wanted to ask you what that means to you.
I love this quote. I love this quote so, so much. To me, I think what that speaks to is community, actually. You know, a lot of the times, you know, when we're going through crises or whatever it may be, you just kind of want to focus on the people in your immediate circle. But we're all experiencing this together in one way or another. If we're not, you know, it's a shared experience that we may have had. So I think it really highlights the importance of showing up, maybe when you don't want to show up, when you don't have to show up, but you should show up. I think it just speaks to, like, the collective as a whole. And I think that's why that speaks to me. No one's ever asked me that question, but I've always just resonated with it.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we just replayed a segment from March this year that featured as part of FBI Radio's Race Matters and Young Prodigy Mentorship Radio Series. And this conversation was between guest producer Virginia Barahona and community builder and Young Prodigy founding director Maya Ihmeje. And this was a poignant conversation unraveling the contradictions of the so-called justice system. And it made clear the work of Young Prodigy as an organization that does incredible labor to center young people whose experiences of the prison industrial complex often goes unnoticed. Now it is 7:38 in the morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with our next interview for the day.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersects
where we're both disabled. It doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Rally to Save Public Housing. Over 10,000 residents are set to be displaced, with 6,660 homes to be demolished across 44 public housing towers. All this in an ever-worsening housing crisis. Join us at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 30th of May at 11 a.m. and then march to the Atherton Gardens public towers in Fitzroy as we fight to save the towers, people's homes and the communities in and around them. After the rally will be a community festival at the towers. The Victorian Labor Government is determined to demolish and privatise public housing and sell off public land to developers. See you on Saturday 30th of May. Together we can stop this madness. Save Public Housing Collective is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we just wanted to remind you about a couple of events that are happening today and in the coming days. Now, first up is the NARM Community Vigil for Kumanjai Little Baby, which is an event that has been called as part of a national series of vigils for Kumanjai Little Baby, where community is invited to stand together in grief, solidarity and healing. Now, this is, again, today, Thursday the 7th of May, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. with a 6 p.m. start for the vigil at the Aborigines Advancement League, number 2 Watt Street in Thornbury. And attendees are asked to please bring a candle and to wear pink. We also want to remind listeners about something we mentioned earlier in the show today, and that is the National Day of Action to Protect Our NDIS. And that's coming up on Saturday, the 9th of May from 1 p.m. outside the State Library of Victoria. Now, to find the time and locations of other national actions, you can also head to Instagram and look up Protect Our NDIS. Stay tuned. We'll be with you all the way through to 8:30 in the morning.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman, with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast. Streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and now we are joined by Chris Cristoforo, who is the CEO of VADA, who joins us again to discuss the Report 25, the latest report in National Wastewater Drug Monitoring Program, and it's based on new data that is collected between December 2024 and 2025, and really paints a picture of the current illicit drug market and levels, as well as drug consumption habits. And then we'll also be talking about the budget and the impact of the AOD sector. How are you, Chris?
Good morning, Inez. How are you going?
I'm good. Lovely to have you back again and to talk about such an important issue. I know that the budget is telling us a lot about the AOD sector, but before we dive into that, can you tell us a little bit more about the report, who it's done by, and what is wastewater analysis?
Thanks, Inez. So the 25th report of the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission is... effectively an annual report of an agency that coordinates police intelligence nationally and internationally as well. This report is, it's the 25th report in the ninth year of wastewater analysis, which is effectively testing of wastewater that, captures excretions across different parts of the country. I think they claim to cover about 50% of the population through the testing. It's non-invasive. It's basically biological data. It's really an effective way of getting some insights, as you said, in terms of what's sort of prevailing within the illicit drug market and within consumption habits more broadly.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that with other collections or survey data, like having to self-report or do like the National Drug Household Survey, it takes a lot of power, time and power, and being able to have another form of analysis, wastewater analysis, is so useful in so many other ways. And I know that this wastewater analysis has told us about some really insightful things about particular illicit drug market levels and how it's quite record levels of illicit drug use through this analysis. Could you tell us a little bit more about what the wastewater analysis and the report has told us about levels?
It's been quite confronting to see that, despite, the best efforts of law enforcement to disrupt supply, I think that, it's pretty well known that, the market itself is pretty resilient. Criminal entities will find ingenious ways to, supply their products, and there's obviously quite a strong demand for illicit drugs across the community. So, a lot of the drug types that have been reported on are about 20% up across the country. Particularly stimulants, methamphetamine and cocaine are seeing extraordinary rise. It probably correlates with what, VADA's hearing through its members about you know, the basically levels of consumption and how that really sort of complicates people's treatment and, you know, requires sort of different levels of investment when it comes to supporting people when they're looking to beat a habit.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, conscious that it is, you know, by the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission. It's the 25th report, but, yeah, we're seeing really record levels of consumption with heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine use. And I know that the consequences of, not the consequences, but I guess the harms that really intersect with all the current issues happening in the AOD sector and the budget is being released. Could you talk a little bit more about, yeah, we're seeing where kind of illicit drug use is kind of sitting right now and how it's intersecting with the challenges in the AOD sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the level of complexity that services are trying to deal with at the moment. I think, you know, the problem is that, you know, we've got a service system that was pretty much designed, you know, more than a decade ago. So in terms of, you know, the way that, you know, from the whole continuum of prevention, early intervention, you know, treatment and harm reduction, I think the problem is that we don't have a fit-for-purpose system to respond to our current reality. And, you know, really disappointed, I think, again, with the state budget that it, you know, fails to kind of recognise the enormity of the situation and how we, you know, really need to mobilise more resources, more strategic coordination and more urgency about responding to these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Vada and so many other people have come on the show to talk about, particularly since the pandemic, how like pretty much AOD use and treatment times have really pretty much doubled. And it's, you know, with the increasing like privatization of healthcare and treatment care, it's so, like the treatment wait times are really, really dire. We've seen like record like fatal overdose numbers from illicit drug use. It is genuinely such an urgent issue. And I know, yeah, hoping that the budget and the AOD sector is well funded and really well supported is what we always hope for. But yeah, I was wondering when you saw the budget, what were your hopes for the sector and like why do you feel like it fell short this time?
Well, you know, I think there is definitely, you know, in fairness, I think, to the government, there is a need to kind of do the foundational work. I don't disagree. I think, you know, there's, you know, we've got a system that's been described as, you know, mind-bogglingly complex to navigate. So, you know, the people that we know that are kind of, you know, waiting for help, so they're already sort of through the front door. I mean, that's just a small proportion of the people that probably would like help or need help and aren't getting it. So I think, you know, in fairness, there is a need to definitely do some foundational work about redesigning our service system, rethinking the true cost of providing support in today's age. But, you know, I guess given the, you know, as you said, as we said earlier, the growth in levels of consumption of, you know, all drug types over the last 12 months, and particularly over the last 5 years, then I just want to see more urgency in terms of, our Department of Health and the Victorian government and the Australian government as well, just working in a more coordinated way to sort of develop solutions that are going to, you know, help communities across this state.
Yeah, I think you really highlighted an important point of how we need so much better coordinated systems and responses to, you know, fatal overdose deaths, to, you know, yeah, disaster relief, naloxone trade. There's so much reduced wait times. And I know that this is such an important issue, particularly knowing that, you know, they're so-called the support that the government wants to provide. What support is currently, been submitted in the budget that is positive or helpful?
I mean, I guess, you know, there's obviously a continuation of some really important harm reduction initiatives. you know, the Victorian Pill Testing Service has been refunded for a further 2 years. And
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously super important. It's a, you know, it's a frontline service that kind of is that, you know, provides that, you know, often a first point of contact to people that are using drugs and allows them to sort of know what they're consuming and have those conversations with health professionals and harm reduction workers around understanding the impacts of their choices. So, yeah, really pleased to see that refunded for a further 2 years. Similarly, the public intoxication response, it's, you know, there will be some change. We're still sort of trying to understand what that is. But, you know, great to see the Aboriginal-led solutions around responding to public intoxication are going to continue to be funded right across the state. So, again, I think that's a really big positive. There's some innovation in pharmacotherapy as well, some low-dose methadone programs that will be rolled out, an Aboriginal pharmacotherapy program, which is really, really important. I think there's a dire need for some you know, culturally led harm reduction services across the state. So really, really good to see. And I guess, yeah, like I said, the, you know, I guess VADA called for, you know, funding for the implementation of the AOD strategy. And while we don't know the full detail yet, I think there is certainly an allocation within the budget to support that work. So, you know, it's, you know, great that that'll happen, but my concern is what is, you know, if we're sort of doing the foundational work to redesign things and rethink things, you know, doesn't mean that we're not going to see change for the next 3 to 5 years. And if that's the case, you know, that's alarm bells for me because, you know, the data is saying that we need solutions now, not 5 years away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're desperate for more coordinated and, you know, better public health responses, and particularly, as you said, more culturally relevant and responsive. And yeah, I think that's really across the board. And for just before, as we're wrapping up, sorry, how can you, our listeners, learn more about, you know, the wastewater analysis or the AOD sector's budget report and, yeah, really support VADA's efforts to change that?
Yeah. I mean, so I would recommend subscribing to the VADA newsletter. So, you know, sort of via email. So, you know, you just sort of go to our website, vada.org.au, and, yeah, subscribe because, yeah, I mean, there's part of our purpose, of course, is to shine a light on the issues that are being experienced in the community and across the service system. So always a really good way to sort of know what's happening. You know, we're sort of in the you know, looking at the upcoming state election as well and what our engagement is around that. So hopefully, you know, when we've got our election platform finalised and released, it might be good to touch base with you again and see how we can sort of, you know, activate some of your listeners to get involved.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Chris, and I hope you have a really good rest of your day. Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Inez. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Chris Cristoforo, who's the CEO of VADA, joining me to discuss the National Wastewater Drug Monitoring Report that really reports record levels of illicit drug use, as well as drug consumption habits, the budget, and the AOD sector.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land.
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yen Up Us Iran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just ticking over to 8 o'clock, and we are now joined by Craig Wilkins, National Co-Director of the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance, or MDCA, who's speaking with us today about the review that's currently underway into the operation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, the framework that governs Australia's largest river system. MDCA's submission to the review draws attention to significant concerns regarding the achievement of the plan's objectives, particularly in regard to sustainable and climate change-sensitive environmental management. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining us. Now, I wanted to begin by going back. Take us to the establishment of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan in 2012. What were some of those key water management and protection priorities shaping the plan's development, and how do you think they hold up now?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on this morning. So the story actually starts even earlier in terms of that what happened when settlers, the white settlers, came to Australia. We kind of broke a 60,000-year history of careful management of the river system by First Nations people, and you thought of the river as being an ongoing source of water for agriculture and irrigation. And there was more and more water taken out and less left in the river. And so that was all a gradual trend until the Millennium Drought hit in the turn of the century, and suddenly the water stopped. The rainfall stopped. There was massive issues right along the river, and so the thinking at the time then was that there needed to be a significant reversal of that historical over extraction of water, and so the intention of the plan was to develop a whole series of outcomes that would mean the river stayed healthy, and in particular, they were based on protecting things like the Ramsar wetlands, which are internationally significant areas of migratory bird habitat. So there was a whole lot of priorities put into place to make sure that the river was in a healthier state. And essentially, I mean, in terms of how they hold up now, the actual priorities are still incredibly important. But the big challenge is they just haven't been achieved as yet. And a big part of the reason for that is that only 2/3 of the water that was originally planned to be delivered under the plan has actually been delivered so far. So we are a long way from achieving the original plan's objective in terms of reversing that historical over-extraction.
Yeah, I really appreciate you drawing attention to the fact that this plan has been put in place in the wake of colonial disruption of an already existing sustainable management system. Now, I wanted to turn to then that mismatch between the priorities and aspirations of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan and, its ability to incorporate a long-term strategy for effective and sustainable governance in the face of climate change. Now, you've mentioned that how things have been tracking and not really meeting those priorities. But how forward-thinking do you think the plan was in terms of addressing ongoing climate change, including mitigating against the potential for basin mismanagement itself to exacerbate climate change effects in the river system?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the quite amazing things that happened in that creation of the Basin Plan was that There was a decision to not incorporate forecasts around climate change, essentially because it was too difficult and too challenging, because even back then there was a very strong sense that the longer-term trend for the basin was hotter and drier, particularly in the southern basin in terms of lower New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia. And so the decision was made that that it was just it was going to be make too much of a shift in terms of water allocation away from irrigation. And it was essentially just kicked along the road until now, when we're reviewing the plan. So for 10 years, there hasn't been climate change adaptation or forecasting built into the plan.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking us through that. And I guess, you know, that brings us to today, where the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is currently in the midst of a review process. And in the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance's submission, you've highlighted that, quote, the Basin Plan is failing to meet its core objectives and is not compatible with achieving the objectives of the Water Act, end quote. So take us through some of your headline concerns here, including, you know, that reference to the Water Act, and also some of your recommendations for change.
Yes, so the head of powers for the Murray-Darling Basin Plan to enable the federal government to step in some places override the states came through the Water Act. And the Water Act uses international obligations to give it that legislative weight to be able to do its work. And so in terms of a natural flow through in terms of what the plan is supposed to achieve, it's supposed to achieve the objectives of the Water Act. And the Water Act, being those international obligations, are things like the Australia's commitment to protect the Ramsar wetlands. And so Ramsar was an international agreement around the sort of health of wetlands. And so there are 16 Ramsar wetlands across the basin, and so Australia signed up internationally to protect them, and that's where the power for the legal power for the plan comes from. And so when we look at if the plan is a success, we need to look back on and see if those Ramsar wetlands have been protected properly, have they been degraded, and our concern is that many of these critical wetlands aren't getting the water they need. There is a bit of a prioritisation towards these iconic ones in particular, but overall, if you look at the whole basin, only around 4% of wetlands get the water they need. And in fact, there's around 40% of wetlands across the whole system that have not received any water at all for the last few decades. And that's deeply concerning, because, I mean, a wetland without water is not a wetland. And then, you know, flowing on from that, because the wetlands are the heart of where, you know, the habitat for nature is, you have huge impacts in terms of migratory bird numbers, native fish numbers, health of native forests. So you've got black box and yellow gum and even the iconic river red gums forests, which are all struggling, and a whole lot of threatened and endangered species that are under enormous stress, because we've essentially stopped a river being able to do what it naturally does, which is to flow, which is to rise and fall and have that natural rhythm which it needs for its health. So we think in terms of what needs to change and what needs to bring the river back to health, there are four main themes that we've been focusing on, and they are climate. So as was mentioned before, about ensuring that any future decisions around how much water is used for irrigation versus how much water is left for the environment needs to consider climate. Secondly, it's around connectivity. So making sure the river actually connects from the headwaters right through to the sea and flows freely as to allow all its natural river values to be achieved, and also connect between the river channel and the surrounding backwaters and billabongs and creeks and the other sort of parts of the river system. That's the second one, so connectivity. The third is around what's called constraints. And so at the moment, there's a lot of restriction on the ability to get water from the river channel into those backwaters and billabongs and creeks. And as I said before, that has a huge impact in terms of wetland health. And the fourth C that we talk about, so we've got climate, connectivity, constraints, and then culture. So as I mentioned before, around that ongoing First Nations connection to water, there's a really big unfinished piece around water justice. And so we think in terms of any plan going forward, it needs to address that principle, which is aqua nullius. So I'm sure most people have heard of terra nullius in terms of when white settlers came and took land away from First Nations people. They also took water away, and water is such a central and integral part of the 40 First Nations who live across the basin, their daily practice and their life and their culture. And so we need to address that historic stealing of the water away from those First Nations people.
Yeah, I really love you ending on aqua nullius and linking that to terra nullius as sort of the foundation for how, you know, we've gotten this so wrong over time. And I do want to ask about the potential that this review provides to engage into some serious course correction. You know, what are the risks of continuing to get things wrong? How do we balance those competing concerns around agricultural irrigation and you know, demands for those kinds of allocations versus wetland irrigation, First Nations, you know, cultural rights and custodianship over the river? What scope do you see for change?
This is one of those critical moments when we do have to make change. The under the Water Act, the Basin Plan is reviewed every 10 years, and so this is the first major review since the Basin Plan was put into place. So it is a once in a generation opportunity that we need to seize to make change, because currently we are not achieving, as I said before, some of the key objectives of the Basin Plan. And I think there's a huge opportunity to see the work of the Basin Plan as being essential to Australia's global biodiversity framework targets, also its response to climate change. So if we get it right across the basin, it could be Australia's largest nature restoration project. It could be Australia's largest climate adaptation project. It's an opportunity to make sure that that this huge part of Australia and its most important water source is healthy for the future and for those communities that rely upon on the water. It's essential for their well-being and for us as a nation. We can't have, you know, food security without water security. We need that healthy river to ensure that the food production that takes place across the basin continues. It also means we meet our international obligations to look after these precious places of nature. So, and then if we get it wrong, we've got the continuation of what's happened before in terms of mass fish kills and blue-green algae outbreaks and loss of these incredible plant species, fish and birds and frogs and others that are currently under threat. So there's enormous amount of things at stake. It is a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and it's really important that we pay attention and make sure the next plan is fit for the future.
Absolutely. And now just in closing, Craig, I did want to ask, submissions to the review are closed, but where can people get involved in the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance's work and find out more?
Yeah, so with probably the simplest way is to go to our website, which is www.mdca, so Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance, mdca.org.au. And we've got various ways that people can get involved in terms of signing up, connecting, and we really would love people to get involved, pay attention. There's a lot of powerful interests who like the fact that that ordinary citizens don't tend to pay much attention to water, yet we all know that water is life and we need to pay attention. So it would be fantastic if people sign up and get involved.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much, Craig. Really appreciate your time this morning.
No worries. My pleasure.
And that was Craig Wilkins, National Co-Director of the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance, who spoke with us about the review that's underway into the operation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, which again is the framework governing Australia's largest river system. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM and is just coming up to 8:16 in the morning.
I want to drop food, not bombs. Hot trains, bottles, give it every info shop. I want to give free therapy out in the park. Go to free school, jump to that practice box. Drop food, not bombs.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a food, not bombs flyer on the road. And I had like this fist with a carrot. And carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff. And I got in touch.
I guess rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
Food, not bombs. 3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are heading into the final segment of our show today. We're joined now by Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria to continue our conversation about serious issues with the City of Melbourne's so-called Community Safety Officer program after revelations that CSOs had allegedly been encouraged to use force against rough sleepers in the CBD if they deemed it necessary. Now, they're going to share some updates about responses from the City of Melbourne since this news broke, including the outcome of a meeting between Homeless Persons Union of Victoria and Lord Mayor Nick Rees earlier this week. Now, HPUV is holding a public gathering outside Melbourne Town Hall from 5 p.m. next Tuesday, and you can find out more about how to get involved in the Big Lean and keep up with HPUV's work by heading to Homeless Persons Union Vic on Instagram. But for now, good morning, Kelly and Danny.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining me in the studio today. Now, I wanted to start off by asking you about how the general public have engaged with concerns in, relation to that article from April 10th in The Age revealing that really concerning behaviour by the CSOs had allegedly been sanctioned by the City of Melbourne. Have you noticed any changes in public conversation after these revelations?
Oh, so by the public, who do you mean, Priya?
That's a very good question. Maybe you can break it down for us.
Well, we're getting a lot of great support on our social media, bit the institutional voice, organisational voices, the silence is absolutely deafening. So we've had little success in drawing out, services that work with people experiencing homelessness, leaders in this space, in homelessness. Their voices are just not there, and that's really quite devastating.
Yeah, and when you talk about services, these are services that are getting funding to provide, what are sometimes life-saving supports to folks who they can't access them from anywhere else. And so having those organizations stay silent on this issue, I can imagine is very concerning, and maybe, does speak to that broader culture of dehumanizing folks who sleep rough or who are homeless that Spike and I had discussed. Now, has the City of Melbourne provided a public response to former CSO Joel Owen's allegations, as well as some of that testimony you've been sharing from people sleeping rough in the CBD about the use of force practices?
No, nothing public, Priya. We went to speak with the Lord Mayor and a number of other kind of bureaucrats or head of operations at the City of Melbourne on Monday, and we asked them flat out what their response was to the Joel Owen's allegations in The Age, and they said they hung him out to dry, really, and said that there was nothing to it. He was just a disgruntled former employee. And then we said, well, it's not just Joel Owen's claims. We have a number of eyewitness accounts, and what do you say to that? And they said, oh, we haven't received any complaints. And that's as far as it went.
Yeah, I think there's an issue here around how difficult it is to go through the complaints process. You know, most folks sleeping rough don't have access to internet and can't go through the online complaints program, and nor do they have trust in the system to do that process anyway. So I think that definitely contributes to, the lack of complaints City of Melbourne is sort of talking about. But I guess our concern is, even if this is a disgruntled employee, like the fact that there were so many deficiencies in terms of the human rights assessment that City of Melbourne are meant to engage with when doing policy making, the language they're using around antisocial behaviour and perceived safety, this sort of creates an environment where there's so much discretion and human rights aren't at the forefront. And we're sort of saying, well, even if that is the case, that he was sort of one employee, doing the wrong thing, like they've created that environment that he thought that was okay.
Yeah, it does strike me as well that, the salacious breaking news was around a former employee really blowing the whistle on these practices rather than the, huge amount of testimony that Homeless Persons Union of Victoria has been, gathering and publicizing over months about the impacts of the program. So, I see how in these kinds of processes, institutions can say, oh, that's just anecdotal evidence. Oh, that's just one or two people's experiences. But in fact, these are the people that we should be listening to.
And yeah, it's deafening, the silence or the denial from the system. So we just got to keep fighting real hard, and the change is going to come from the grassroots until we can turn the tide on this.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of that, Homeless Persons Union of Victoria did encourage people to make submissions on the draft budget that the City of Melbourne had put out, which was planning to allocate a further massive amount of funding to double the CSO officer program. Danny, can you tell us about Homeless Persons Union's submission to the budget?
Yeah, definitely. So I think first and foremost, what was glaring for us is that, Victoria has a human rights charter and all public authorities are expected to consider those rights when making policy decisions. And City of Melbourne, while engaged with the assessment, did that really sort of poorly. So yes, they identified that some human rights were being engaged and limited, but the second test where you actually have to justify why it's reasonable, necessary, proportionate and so on to actually limit those rights, they just left that blank. So they didn't even bother to justify why they're limiting human rights and then just went on to tick that it's compatible anyway. So we've got real concerns around that because human rights should be at the forefront. We have that charter for a reason. So just to not even bother engaging with that assessment as they're meant to do as a public authority is quite concerning to us. So that was sort of forefront of our submission. We also have other sort of concerns just around the terminology, like what is antisocial behaviour, what is perceived safety. I guess those terms are quite ambiguous and also quite subjective depending on who's looking at it, you know. And so we're sort of thinking about, okay, is it that we're uncomfortable, you know, is middle class uncomfortable seeing poverty? In which case the answer is not to move that out of sight. So that was sort of what our thinking was around that. You know, is this actually causing physical harm if not stopped? In which case, absolutely, we can look at solutions. But are we uncomfortable with people sleeping rough? Because that's not the sort of pathway we want to go down and just moving people on. The other thing we were sort of concerned about just around the pilot program, so the evaluation that City of Melbourne did, it really didn't achieve many of the stated aims. So yes, it was effective in creating a better sense of safety among local law officers, but in terms of community safety more broadly, it actually wasn't effective in doing that. They only sort of recorded 50 referrals. So they talk about, oh, you know, don't worry, we're going to make referrals for rough sleepers. You know, we're going to link people into a pathway out of homelessness, where they only engage 50 referrals, which is quite low when you look at the City of Frankston and their Connectors program. They did double the amount of referrals. So you have to sort of make the link around, you know, security guards dressed in sort of pseudo police uniforms. That's not really conducive to engagement for people who are marginalised. So there's just a bit of a disconnect from our perspective around those sort of things.
Totally. And a referral is not the same thing as somebody actually getting meaningful support.
No, not at all. So I think there's a misconception that, you know, if people just engage with the supports that are there, that there is housing if they want it. And that's just, you know, plainly not the case. So the public housing wait times is 7.2 months at the moment. And, you know, even if you do agree to a referral to crisis accommodation, it can take months to get you into that crisis accommodation. That is time limited. So a lot of them are only 12-week stays. And so you get exited back into rough sleeping. And, you know, so the cycle continues. You're more distrustful for services. So it's not a solution. And I think that's a really key misconception that, you know, yes, we support the City of Melbourne putting extra support services in place, but that's actually not conducive to a pathway out of homelessness. That is a long and winding pathway. And so I kind of see City of Melbourne's role, like, let's make life easier for rough sleepers while they're waiting for their long-term housing offer. Let's not make it harder for people.
Yeah. And that 7.2 months is for people that are like acutely experiencing homelessness, which I think also doesn't necessarily capture all of the folks that are sleeping rough, whose application status may not have changed in that time just because of a mistrust in services or an inability to access them because of this deterrent force that's now in the city. Now, I just wanted to turn, before we wrap up, to talking about the Big Lean event that you've got on next year. Kelly, can you tell us about that?
Next week, not next year.
Oh, my gosh, next week. Oh, what is time?
Yeah, so what we're hearing anecdotally, as recently as yesterday morning, people are being constantly moved on from leaning against, sitting against buildings in the CBD and from begging alms. And so we thought, let's have a big communal lean against the Melbourne Town Hall. Great community atmosphere out there proudly. Next Tuesday from 4:30 p.m. we're going to have DJ Mia Marcel spinning tunes. We want everybody to rock up. And then at 5 o'clock we'll have a few short speeches and a short open mic, and then we'll have a big lean around the perimeter of the town hall. We want people to snake around the town hall. We'll have some photo ops there. We'll be doing some videoing. And then from about 5:45, we'll all rock into the Melbourne City Council meeting, where they claim they want to hear from the public on their views around the you know, the beefing up of the community safety officer program. So we're encouraging all Melbournians who really care about this to come to the Big Lean next Tuesday and join us in solidarity with our CBD homeless community.
Yeah, amazing. And, you know, if they say that they haven't heard any complaints, they will be able to hear them next week. So everybody, please join in next Tuesday from 4:30 p.m. outside Melbourne Town Hall.
And if you can come to 3CR in the next few days, we have a number of flyers and posters and they're looking really schmicko. So we'd love people to put them up around town.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kelly and Danny. And follow the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria on Instagram for more.
Thanks for having us, Priya.
Thank you, Priya.
Amazing. And that's all we've got time for on today's show. So a very quick rundown. We started off hearing a poem by Text a Queen called Landfill. We played a segment from FBI Radio's Race Matters and Young Prodigy. We heard from Chris Christoforou, CEO of VADA, speaking about report number 25 of the National Wastewater Drug Monitoring Program. Craig Wilkins, the National Co-Director of the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance, joined us to talk about the Murray-Darling Basin Plan Review. And then you just heard from Kelly and Danny from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, speaking about serious issues with the City of Melbourne's Community Safety Officer Program and what you can do to get involved with the Big Lean next Tuesday. That's all we've got time for today, but we'll catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast. Stay tuned now for Lost in Science.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.